Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on the podcast this week is Max Gulde, co-founder and CEO of Constellar.
What we're looking at was two things. It was impact on the one hand side, so what are the biggest challenges, but then also the time scale. When will these challenges have a really big effect? And that's the reason why we then started with water, because carbon, for example, is a magnificent scale, right? The amplitude of this problem is just amazingly large. However, water will probably overtake carbon in a few years from now in terms of amplitude, and it will be a lot more severe a lot earlier. So it's a lot shorter timescale. We're not looking at 2050. We're not looking at 2070. We're looking at seven harvests from now. In seven harvests from now, if we don't have a good solution implemented, the world will, I wouldn't say be on fire, but we definitely live in a lot more stressed world.
This is Max. He's a prototype of a tech entrepreneur on a mission, a massive mission. By training, he's an experimental physicist with a strong background in material science, computational physics, image processing, methodology development, and the ingestion of scientific work into applications. In April 2020, he co-founded Constellar, a German deep tech company at the interface of agriculture and space. Max is an inventor of the Constellar core technology and holds several patents. Their mission? The provision of a robust databases to drive more crop per drop and help feed 10 billion people by 2050. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Max to my podcast. We explore the challenges Max has been going through to convince the naysayers and what he has learned from that. He explains what they have done to break a huge global problem into a manageable structure, and what choices have been fundamental to deliver remarkable impact and grow predictable traction. Last but not least, he shares his recommendation for building a software business that has staying power. By listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, by getting everybody to see and acknowledge the severity of the problem doesn't mean they will buy or invest. Secondly, how to approach a problem that's beyond imagination in size. Thirdly, how to go about segmenting the market when no one owns the problem that you solve best. And fourthly, how to leverage positioning to grow momentum when the market doesn't really see the urgency of the problem yet. Well, hi Max. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Hi, Ton. I'm happy to be here. Nice meeting you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I saw the announcement of your recent funding on Strictly VC, and that triggered me to start looking into what your company Constellar is doing. And it inspired me. And I think it's the mission that you're on is one that is badly needed in the world. So hence, I immediately reached out with video to speak to you and to see whether you would be a guest. And here we are. So to get started, we're going to talk a lot about your company, of course, but a little bit about you. What drives you? Where do you get your energy from?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I didn't know for a long time what's driving me. Now the short answer is I would like to have an impact, a positive societal impact, and hand over a better planet to my kids than the planet we're living on at the moment, which is still great, but there's definitely a downward slope in certain directions. And the journey I had to take was a bit more lengthy. So I worked 10 years in academia. I actually built microscopes. I was working at the interface of nanostructures and optics. It was electron microscopes. That's what I did for a PhD and then moved to molecular dynamics. And it was really great work the group was doing. We built fantastic machines in the end. And we used those to publish interesting papers and then get grants to build better machines, to get more papers and grants and so on. And I was at some point a bit dissatisfied. Didn't really know why, since I didn't know how or when or if even this would ever find its way into something useful. not scientifically useful and interesting, but really societally useful. So I then tried to step into towards industry, but not quite into the industry. I started working at a research organization in Germany, which is called Fraunhofer. So it's the largest European research organization for applied science. And I was going into the planetary sciences there and looking at impact, but literal impact of meteoroids, for example, being a group which dealt with space. My reasoning was that any of the big challenges we have would probably have, from tackled point of view, would make heavy use of three emerging technologies, which is robotics, big data, including data fusion and so on and so forth, machine learning, AI. And I also believe that a lot of it will be enabled by whatever technology we had in space, or we will have in space at some time. So I joined a space research center and eventually became a mission scientist for a space mission, which is exciting. And I really love the technology, and I still do love the technology. And we developed a lot of very nifty designs and things which have amazing potential. I was, however, a bit, again, dissatisfied with the use case, because I thought, okay, we have this amazing technology and we're using it for something was in the direction of defense and intelligence, which I can't completely align with. So then I tried to transition this into the, let's say, the civil realm. And there were a couple of thoughts, everything from wildfire detection, because it was infrared technology, to, let's say, smart city building, detecting urban heat islands and all these things, and obviously agriculture. And we tried very many angles, and it was the first time, having been a bit, I would say until that point, I was rather successful in, let's say, writing papers or grants and so forth. And suddenly I hit a wall. And I wrote 14 applications and all of them were refused, right? So I failed 14 times in a row, which was the first time for me. I was like, oh, okay. So that's interesting. Why do I think this is such a fantastic idea, but I always get no's from all the directions? And at some point, it struck me that it's not the problem. The problem everybody sees, the problem of water, is easy to understand. It is that the risk profile of doing such a thing as we are doing now is just not really matching well with, let's say, the funding mechanism and the risk appetite of, let's say, funding agencies back then. So we said, okay, the only way to do it, and I initially refused to do so, was like, do it yourself, right? It's the only way. You need to take responsibility and do it yourself. So we then decided, and my two co-founders and me, that's Marius, who's an aerospace engineer, and Chris, who basically grew up on the farm but came from the insurance industry, said, okay, we need to do this ourselves. And then we started 2.5 years back. And this was kind of the point where things suddenly came together. And now it's really easy to get motivated, because you get up in the morning, usually the kids wake you up in the morning, and then you know what you're doing it for. And it's the first time that, let's say, my technological interest, but also this feeling that I'm doing things for the right cause, are entirely aligned. And that's it's a privilege to have this feeling.
Yeah, I can imagine. So I like the introduction, and I can actually see like how you're exploring. And what did you see at some point while you were at Fraunhofer? Where you believe this cannot go on any longer. Where did the connection, was a connection made between water, agriculture, technology, and the problem that's out there?
Yeah. So the reasoning was, now in hindsight, everything seemed very clear. But back then, I know we were struggling a lot with kind of just grasping the scope of the problem and the challenge. So one of the challenges I always had is that, the same for my co-founders, that some of the challenges are just so amazingly big, right? And we're always looking at, okay, how do you solve this amazing challenge? If you have a planetary size problem, you kind of need a planetary size tool how to tackle this. And we looked at the numbers, they were just astonishing. The amount of water which is going into agriculture, the amount of CO2 which is expelled by human-made fires, the amount of heating and death which are actually caused by heat in cities, right? Because, just excuse the segue, but if we talk about 1.5 degree global warming, this is not evenly distributed, right? Only a very small fraction of the temperature, let's say, of the planetary surface is actually cities. And here will hit the hardest. So if we say 1.5 degree on average, this probably means that we have between 6 and 8 degrees in some cities, which causes a lot of problems. And we've seen this in a 2014 heat wave. I think there were 70,000 people just dying as an effect of heat and stress symptoms based on heat. So looking at these numbers, it was humbling. That could you even think of trying to solve this? And the reasoning we had was that if you look at the problem at this scale, you need, as I said, a tool which is operating on the same scale. And then we immediately closed the link to space, right? Yeah. Because with space, yes, it's a distributed tool, right? And you're not everywhere at the same time all the time. But it means that for the first time, you would have something which is, let's say, acting, or which is monitoring something which allows you to act at the scale which would be needed to solve this problem.
Yeah.
So this was a bit the reasoning behind that.
Okay. Yeah. And then, of course, I mean, I've had these discussions many times, you know, you got a huge problem at the society scale, but then at the end, it's like tying it back to the expensive problem and maybe a business level or something where you can actually start talking to, because no one owns the problem at the end. So where do you start? So, I mean, how did that go about? Because at the end, who is your customer?
Yeah. It's one of the questions. So before I answer that, just a little anecdote again here. We presented this technology. It was a tech push initially, right? We presented this technology to experts in the industry, space experts at the German Aerospace Center, but also at the European Space Agency. And we were expecting, because we thought, okay, it can't be that simple in the end. So maybe we did the mistake. And initially they were highly skeptical. And at some point we got a call from ESA and they said, well, this is groundbreaking. And we said, okay, good, excellent. So what do we do now? And then they invited us over and we had a first chat before even there was a company, like with investors and all these things. And they kept asking this question. So who's the customer? Who's the beneficiary in the end? And I said, well, beneficiary is easy. That's us. But yeah, okay. So who's the customer? What's the market? What's the market size? What's the total addressable market? We're like, does it matter? Because this is a global problem, right? And if we have a solution to that, there's going to be someone who's going to pay for it. And I said, no, this needs to be a customer. I was like, what? Like, in the end, every single human being will be a customer of that solution. I was like, no, that's not enough. So now, obviously, we have a different perspective on that and we agree. But back then, it was a bit frustrating because from the scientific point of view, it's like, okay, this needs to be done. It's very clear. Everybody agrees this needs to be done. Do I really need to look at who's the customer? Yes, of course, because in the end, someone needs to pay for that, right? And whatever this person, this entity pays needs to be smaller than the benefit they have in a relatively short-term view, actually. And that's just the reality of the market. So here, the customers are actually not the farmers, even though it's for agriculture, but the customers are agri-chemistry, agri-food companies. So companies which are already looking at a lot of area under monitoring, which already have products based on, let's say, digital information, which they offer to their end customers, the farmers, and which would be interested in reducing uncertainty, improving the ability to forecast, and reducing the amount of input, be it water, pesticide, fertilizer they need. And obviously, I mean, we usually picture it as water for agriculture, but it's more than that, right? So the vision is larger than that. The vision is actually that suddenly we arrive at a means of having data-driven governance of the whole planet. And water is one layer, and agriculture is one market in that.
Let me make a small interruption here. Max just made an excellent remark about a challenge many mission-driven SaaS businesses struggle with, the difference between the huge problem and the expensive problem. Max is on a mission to solve a huge global problem, and the obvious thing would be to communicate only about that. The problem is, in order to solve it, it requires the market to adopt it. And for that, you need to win them over on how you're solving their expensive problem first. And then make the fact that they are helping to solve the huge problem by becoming client the icing on the cake. It's a typical trait remarkable software companies master. They sell the idea, not the product. But then they realize also well that they cannot please everyone and that they have to offer something valuable and desirable. And that's how predictable traction starts. And you can master these traits as well. The first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy and inspiration will spark in the next 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
But if you go away, because if you look at how is governance done today, right? So obviously there's like hundreds of satellite systems out there, right? And they can measure all kinds of different spectra, but they're usually measuring at the scale in if it's beyond visual. So if we're looking towards, let's say, the geostationary satellites, which give us a good record of the climate, they usually measure the scale, which is outside the scale a single human or even many humans can act. If I tell you that there's a low level of soil moisture on these 25 square kilometers, it's like, okay, so what do I do now? You can't act on it, right? So it's the wrong spatial scale. And only if you go to smaller spatial scale, if you go in the meter, a couple of meters, maybe a couple of tens of meters scale, then suddenly things become actionable for people. And it's important. You need to bridge that gap. But the problem is that in this regime, we usually only have optical data, visual data, which means that we are relying on technology which is invented for defense intelligence purposes to feature detection. So we're looking at colors. And then this, what we're doing right now, we're looking at these colors. Then we try to interpret a chemical or physical signal. So we're looking at, okay, how green is a leaf? And then we try to estimate, okay, what's the chlorophyll content? But it depends on the geography, on the plant, on the crop cycle, on all these things. So what we propose is actually that that's good, right? That's okay. It's frustrating to work with it because it's so unreliable. But let's add a layer which gives you physical and chemical information. Let's not ask the question, how do I interpret this color into a chemical reading? Let's actually do the chemical reading. Let's not try to, let's say, okay, can I somehow estimate the soil moisture based on, let's say, surface structures in my radar image? No, let's simply measure it by looking at the evapotranspiration, at the loss of water to the atmosphere. And that's the paradigm shift we want. And I think once we have such a data set, this enables a ton of use cases, not only in agriculture, but beyond. So it's really a fundamental different approach to how we do governance, and that governance at a scale where every single human suddenly has the chance to actually act on that scale. I can't act on a square kilometer, but I can act on a few square meters. That's something I can do.
Yeah, my backyard.
Yeah, exactly. You can do something in your backyard. Yeah.
So, and I completely understand the technology opens up for so many use cases, but at the end, you have to start somewhere. And I've had so many people on the podcast. Yesterday, I actually had someone in my CEO mastermind also that said how they started was, the world is open in terms of the opportunity, but it didn't sell to anybody. Yeah, it just gave unhappy customers. The idea was fantastic, and then the implementation of it was poor. What did you do in order to get started? And how did you find, for example, where you solved the biggest possible problem that was critical to solve, and where you could make a difference?
Yeah. So what we're looking at was two things. It was impact on the one hand side. So what are the biggest challenges? But then also the time scale. When will these challenges have a really big effect? And that's the reason why we then started with water, because carbon, for example, is a magnificent in scale, right? The amplitude of this problem is just amazingly large. However, water will probably overtake carbon in a few years from now in terms of amplitude, and it will be a lot more severe a lot earlier. So looking at these things.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah. So for example, if we look at carbon is warming the atmosphere, right? And it's a problem for everybody. So we have estimates it's going to 2050, then depending on how we depend, it might start cooling down around 2100 and so on. So we might or might not live to see that. If we look at water, water costs right now are somewhere between 300 and 400 billion US dollar per year in agriculture. That's a pure cost of actually buying water. We're wasting around 60% of that. At the moment, that's not our own data, but it's data of the FAO. And water prices will increase until 2030 by 6 to 12 times, which means that suddenly a lot of agriculture will become unviable. And water waste is not only not economic anymore, because suddenly it's obviously a trillion dollar and also a trillion euro problem, but suddenly it is actually, I would say, unethical to waste water. So it's a lot shorter timescale. We're not looking at 2050. We're not looking at 2070. We're looking at seven harvests from now. In seven harvests from now, if we don't have a good solution implemented, the world will, I wouldn't say be on fire, but we definitely live in a lot more stressed world, and water stressed particularly.
Well, I mean, it has an impact, of course, on the yields. You know, how much can be harvested?
If there's not enough, how much can be harvested? Yeah. Just to give you an idea, I mean, water is just one thing, right? It's a central resource we need to drive our food system. But there's going to be wars on water, right? When we see what happens in northeastern Africa, definitely is going to be wars on water. If we look at, for example, let's stick with Africa, and water is just one solution, but it's a far bigger problem. I think about one third of the calories in Africa are actually stemming from corn, right? Or from maize, depending on which part of the globe you're living on. So maize is something which is relatively sensitive to heat in general. So for every degree above 30 degrees centigrade, for one day, you're actually losing about 1% of the yield, which means that 5% at 35 degrees is 5 times 5, 25%, one quarter of the yield would be lost. So looking at the scenario and looking that temperatures are rising, it is expected that somewhere in 2050, we probably only have between 60, maybe 70 to 85% of the yield of today, right? Obviously, we should put a lot of money into, let's say, developing more drought-resistant species and so on and so forth, alternative proteins, blah, 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 all these things, right? But from maize alone, as is today, there's going to be a lot less available. However, the population will have doubled in Africa. So now if you ask, okay, what are, let's say, some of the top five answers, how to solve this problem, what do you do? If you ask people, which would be affected, either nothing, because I can't do anything, I eat less, which is a really, really bad idea, or, well, I just move away. And this obviously affects everybody, right? So it's just this gigantic scope of problems. And the feeling is, and that's the urgency here, the time really is running out how to solve that. And my feeling, it's a guess, let's revisit this in 3 years from now. But my feeling is in 3 years from now, water will play a bigger role let's say, in the global communications than carbon in the atmosphere is today.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, glad I asked the question to give a little bit of context to this, because I didn't even, couldn't even imagine like 10% of what you were just telling. So yeah, okay, you started late, you know, 2020 was the year, middle of COVID, with an enormous problem. And you could already see, of course, what was coming, because at that point in time, it was 9 years, 9.5 years from now. How do you start? Like, what decisions do you make in order to make the biggest possible impact in the shortest amount of time?
Yeah, first of all, I'm a scientist, right? And my background is not agronomy. I'm not a farmer. I'm not from the nations which would be affected first. So the first thing you do is you ask those people who know, right? You find people who know, you find people who are experts in the field. So actually the first months, everything we did was just trying to get hold of as every possible stakeholder. We talked to the big grain traders, to the food companies, we talked to scientists, which have remote sensing background, agronomy background, and so on. And we just gathered information, a lot of information. Because one of the things we've been told, and we believe that right from the start, is don't develop a product. I know you love your tech. Don't develop a product before asking customer first. Once we had, let's say we had accepted that we don't know who the customer is, and we accepted the fact that without the customer, we're probably not going to solve this problem. We then went into it, and we're in a very systematic way. So first asking everybody who actually knows the subject and trying to gather intel as much as possible. Then based on that intel, we started deriving specifications and did sensitivity analysis. So how do we build a system which is solving all these problems? Obviously, there's not a single system which can solve all the problems, but you can find an optimum, a sweet spot where you solve a lot of the problems and the biggest problems. So this was the second part. And then we said, okay, now we need to prove that we actually have a technology which we can adapt in such a way that people start believing us that we can actually solve this problem. So what we did is, after doing this initial analysis, we went into a frenzy and built a space mission. And we built a space mission from, let's say, scratch board to operations in less than 12 months. So we went crazy. We got all the contacts we have, and Fraunhofer was a big help there, right? Because being embedded in an ecosystem which basically has a lot of the capabilities already there is fantastic. We got grant funding. Suddenly things worked. We were considered as a startup and we're eligible to a certain amount of funding. So the funding was there. First investors knocked on the door, obviously still skeptical, not so much on the problem, but obviously on the just the can a company even start solving that, right? Because it is a big thing. We warmed up our industry contacts. We got support from NASA, from Airbus, from ESA, obviously from different other players. And we tried to tie all of this together to show that we do have a solution which could solve this problem. So the big moment then was in earlier this year, in February, where we actually launched the payload after 12 months of crazy work just on the hardware. We're obviously trying to develop the business case. And then it worked. It did work. It didn't work initially. We had to turn it off and on again, the oldest IT trick in the book. Then it did work, and it did work splendidly. And we could show and convince people that, look, this is how it looks and this is working. And even though it's at 1% of the cost of what is currently out there, it's still delivering good to very good results. So let's build this at scale. And this is when we then started triggering all the conversations, which eventually led to the larger funding round. And I mean, we are now 50 people, right? When we started, it was like 3 people working on the weekends. It's obviously a big step from there, but it's still a bigger step to go. And we should be aware that we are right at the beginning, right?
It's a journey.
But it's a journey. It's a fun journey, right? Someone told us very much at the beginning, it's going to be a roller coaster. So back then we smiled and said, okay, so what do you do if you're in a roller coaster? You lift your arms and just enjoy it. And that's what you try to do. It's still a long way to go, but I'm super confident that we'll eventually get there.
Yeah, I can understand that.
In case you haven't heard, it's officially in Abercrombie summer. The ANF Vacation Shop has everything on your packing mood board. I desperately need their new one piece, the ANF Marina. It's strapless, so flattering, and paired with denim shorts will be my go-to beach outfit this summer. Finally, your suitcase isn't complete without finding that dress. You know, the one for the photo shoot. Abercrombie's boho dresses have that perfect beachy romantic look. Make it an Abercrombie summer. Shop their newest arrivals in-store, online, and in the app.
So what has been the hardest nut to crack up to this point? Was it technology? Was it business? Was it something else?
First of all, I think the hardest nuts there are still to crack, right? Really show that this is not only helping, but it's actually sustainable and profitable and so on and so forth. The hardest nuts for us, usually we're not on the technology side, simply because of the backgrounds we have. A lot of the team has engineering background, natural sciences, and so on and so forth. So we're rather confident with handling technology. The hardest nut to translate is actually translating technology into solutions and having a vision for that solution, defining that vision. And that's obviously something which is kind of ever changing in a way, right? So the core stays the same, just the way you present it is always a little bit different. And I think this is it's a nut we haven't really cracked yet, but we're there, we're getting closer.
Yeah, it's such a common thing. I'm in the middle of this with all the positioning work and repositioning work that I do, and it's always about the same thing. You know, how do we explain in simple words to the ideal buyer what this is all about? Because we are we're nuts about the technology, but it's all abracadabra for the outside world.
To be honest, technology doesn't matter, right? And we need to step away and say, okay, how can we explain this without saying what technology we have? Usually what we do now is we don't even tell people that we're using satellites. Eventually they ask, we said, okay, if you can do this any place in the globe, are you using satellites? We say, yes, we're using satellites. But it doesn't really matter, and it shouldn't matter, right? Because it's about solving the problem, not about infrastructure, the technology you build behind. Obviously, we're all techies, but not all of us, but a lot of us are techies, and we love what we're doing. And we obviously also have the respective education. But in the end, we must confess that it's a means to an end.
Yeah, exactly. Totally agree with that. So what I want to kind of dig a little bit into it, February 2020, you launch. Are there now customers that are using this on a day-to-day basis?
Yes, they are actually. So the single payload we launched obviously can't serve at the level of the full value proposition that we can deliver these insights every single day, any place in the globe, right? But it gives a good proxy to what could be. So what we're doing right now is we're running pilots, and we're using all means we have to run these pilots. For some pilots, it's enough that we basically use our data, we merge it with existing other satellite data, and then we come to a conclusion, which is it's still far away from what we would get once we have our own constellation up there, but it's close enough they can get an idea of where this is leading, this is going. In other cases, we actually use drones, let's say, as a supplement. It's a non-scalable supplement, but if you do it on a small scale, it's fine, right? And we try to optimize irrigation. And with other companies, we try to optimize their growth models for their crops. And yeah, there are about a bit more than half a dozen pilots going on at the moment. There will be more next year. So we do get good traction of that. But in the end, let's say the commercial nut, which needs to be cracked, can only be cracked once we actually have capacity in orbit, which can serve at scale. And then we'll see how this actually translates. Again, here, from what I'm seeing, very confident, but it's still a nut we have to crack.
Yeah, exactly. So what have you learned in that process? You know, first of all, to get the first pilots going, does it require a certain mindset? Does it require a certain ambition for your customers?
I think one thing which helps is if you have a bit of the marathon runners, if you see it as a marathon, right, not as a sprint, have a bit of this mindset. So I think being determined on what you want to do, and it's okay to, let's say, adjust the phrasing towards the vision, adjust the way towards the vision. But if you have a clear vision and if you're determined in reaching it, that's a very important factor. So just being stubborn in a certain way, I think that's one of the core characteristics which are important, possibly more important than being just smart or well-educated, or you need to have this grit. Then the second thing is that it's really important to be able to work with a lot of uncertainty, because a lot of the decisions you have to take intuitively from a gut feeling, and not all the decisions are data driven, because you, in order to be fast, you can't always wait to have all the data, but you basically see early trends and then you make a decision. And if you land within plus minus 10% of what would have been the right decision, then it's good, right? That's the second thing. The third thing is that, yes, you feel this growth. You see that it's become more and more people, but you need to stay humble and realistic on where you are on the journey. And the fact is that you are really early on the journey and you should be aware of that. So, and that's kind of the discrepancy sometimes between how startups, and I won't exclude ourselves, represent themselves to the outside and where we actually are, right? And there's a bit of this bridge we need to build and translate into where we want to go, where are we now, and what are realistic next steps, and how confident are we to get there? And it's difficult because on the one side, it's a competitive environment where everybody is kind of stacking claims about claims, and staying honest and realistic on the one hand side without giving up, let's say, or without moving behind the scene is a challenge.
Yeah, I can imagine. Specifically also because you're going to get more and more input from the proof of concepts. So customers are going to go, because of absence of what the total solution is, they're going to take it in their own, try to kind of bend it in their own direction. And before you know it, you end up with something whereby there's nothing that is common anymore. You've moved in six proof of concepts, six different directions. How do you stay on course? Have you got a framework for that? This is how we make decisions, and this is when we say no?
Yes. So we obviously, it depends a little bit of what type of decision is to be made. But in general, yes, we do have a decision framework. And what really helps is the vision, right? So if you align people on the vision, and if you can somehow argue that this step or this decision is bringing you towards the vision, or it's maybe just a distraction, this helps a lot. So having a North Star, having a big, hairy, audacious goal, which you're trying to reach, that really helps in decision making. And some of the decisions are hard, really, really hard, because it feels like this might even be maybe not a step back, but this might not furthering going towards the vision as much as I want, but it also really keeps you focused. And I think that's what it's all about initially. You can spread your focus widely if you're in the ideation phase. Then when it comes to execution, you need to have an extremely narrow focus. And then once you're past a certain point again, you can open up again. But right now we are in this very narrow focus region. Yeah, it does help. Obviously, it also depends a lot with whom you're working, right? And what the relationship between those people are.
Yeah, that has to do, of course, going back to like, who is your customer, your ideal customer? Because if they look alike from the outside, but they're completely different from what they aim for, it can still be dragged in different directions. And I've seen it over and over again. Looking at the time, by the way. So, yeah, around the time that you launched your company, I launched my first book, The Remarkable Effect. Mm-hmm. That's about the 10 traits that define a remarkable software business. Can't imagine it's already that long ago. Being an entrepreneur right now and having started your own business, what do you optimize for to create something that people start talking about and keep talking about?
Mm-hmm. Can you phrase the question slightly differently? Because I'm not entirely sure if I understood them the right way.
Well, remarkable software companies, let's go back to the word remarkable. It's something worth making a remark about, mm-hmm. which of course is what customers are saying and what the outside world is saying about your solution, your company. And once you got something that's worth making a remark about, you know, people talk about it and growth starts and you're doing the right things. Yep. So first of all, the aim is always to get there. And then once you get there and you get success, and you get traction, like then a lot of times people get a little bit easier and go sit a little bit back because the success is there. And it often stalls. So the other thing is also, how do you stay there? Are there any, it's too early on the journey, but what are you doing in order to create something that will help you start growing by word of mouth rather than having to kind of invest millions and millions in marketing?
Yes, no, that's a very good point. So, and you're right, we're not at this point yet, right? But we'll get there eventually. What I would say is that what we need to tie, what we need to make clear is that this is not only a solution which has helped you to save money, which has helped you to, let's say, be conform with whatever ESG guidelines there are, whatever water monitoring, pesticide monitoring, and so on. But it's really something, if you implement this, which is actually good for the planet. And kind of tying these two things together, that it means it's a successful business model for the customer to work with us. Yeah. And on the other hand, they're actually doing something good. I think this can have something, a lasting effect. And that's what we'll be trying to leverage.
Well said. That is the right combination here. And going back to this, to what I said already before, we got the huge problem, societal, that nobody can grasp, nobody's responsible for, but you have to bring those two together. And yeah, that's the right approach to that. Last question then. If you would have to, based on your experience so far being a tech entrepreneur, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you would share with peer tech founders?
Okay, maybe it's a bit specific, right? A lot of the tech founders are possibly a bit younger than I am. But for me, one of the do's is never compromise family, right? So that's the same way. If you're in a business, focus 100% on the business. If you're with a family, with your kids, your partner, whatever, be 100% there. That's definitely one of the do's. One of the don'ts is do not overpromise. Stay honest. If you're a tech founder, you probably have an engineering, scientific, whatever career. It's one of the core values of science. Is this transparency, honesty. If you make a claim, back it up.
Yeah, perfect. Well said. I love that. And you're so right, you know, never compromise family. And it's so often the first thing to do because the business needs to succeed, but your biggest supporter is at home.
And without
those people, you will never make it.
No, definitely. And family includes yourself, right? So don't compromise too much on yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the lesson that I've heard. I mean, I'm writing my second book right now about what we can learn from the last 2.5 years in order to stay resilient and not only survive a crisis, but actually come out stronger. And one of the stronger advices is indeed pay attention to yourself, zoom out, work on your health, because without that, it's going to be a very tough ride.
Yeah, it's not going to be a marathon. It's going to be a sprint.
That's true.
That's not enough.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Max, for sharing the story about Constellar. I'm going to keep following you. And what you do, I'm a big promoter of that. This is so needed. For even realizing it was so urgent. So, make it happen, I would say.
We will make it happen. Thanks, Tom. And thanks for having us here, having me here. It was a pleasure. Always good to, always helps a little bit to reflect on things. So thanks for guiding this discussion and looking forward to meet you again.
Okay, it'll definitely happen. Thank you. And this ends my conversation with Max. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning in to this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Max Gulde, co-founder and CEO of Constellar. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.